Spring is here, and that means hot weather will soon be coming. Are you ready for the heat? I am. Is your home? That's the question. If you're like me and you like your home to stay comfy and cool all summer long, then I recommend talking to my friends at Aquarius Home Services. From AC tune-ups to repairs, Aquarius Home Services is here to help. Their trusted cooling and heating experts will go above and beyond to provide you with a five-star experience from start to finish to make sure your AC unit is ready for the heat. Aquarius believes in earning the right to be recommended, and I recommend them. They're just a click away at AquariusHomeServices.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Due North Outdoors Podcast. It is summertime, basically, overnight here, and today's going to be a special episode. We've got a little bit of a VIP, local celebrity joining the podcast today. Ryan Carter, Minnesota native, former professional hockey player, now an analyst for the Wild on Bally Sports, but also a bit of an outdoorsman in your own right. So today we're going to be talking a little bit of different things, a little bit of hockey, a little bit of broadcasting, but also plenty of outdoors too. Travis, yep. What have you been up to lately?
Catching walleyes, picking around mushrooms. Turkey season is over, but I do have to ask, you kind of left us hanging on your social media. Did you get a turkey or not?
Oh, no, we did not. So I did go out though. So I went with my good friend, Jenny Anderson, girl of 10,000 lakes. So we've been talking for a couple years now about going hunting together. We finally made it happen. She went out a few times for turkeys this year. I went out on her last day. No luck. We got to witness some hens walk through,
Any takeaways from your first turkey hunt?
You know what? What I would say is I've been a little bit intimidated by it, or, you know, just like not necessarily enough, just like thinking that I need to learn more and to practice more and everything before going out. And I say my biggest takeaway, and I said this to her when I left, I was like, I can do this. I'm ready to go. So yeah. I felt like I learned a lot, but I also felt like it's so much more accessible than even I think I knew.
Did you hear any gobbles?
No.
Oh. Other than the ones we were making.
Yeah.
You hear that.
Yeah.
Go, go, go.
Honestly, it was slow. She's like, this is probably the most boring day that I've had, but like got to see plenty of, you know, nature. We got to do a little bit of foraging in there in between, plenty of other types of, you know, critters and stuff. And I got to count at least, you know, 17 or 18 ticks on me. So that was lovely too.
Probably the worst year I think I've ever seen.
It's
for ticks.
Yeah. For ticks.
Yeah.
Like they're everywhere. They're in my lawn. My little one-year-old comes walking up, you know, just waddling up the yard, and there's a tick on her. I'm like, I just want to light the whole forest on fire. I just hate ticks, everything about them.
I almost prefer it to be really heavy, though, because then you know that you have to inspect after you've
it's
been
true.
In there.
You
have to
multiple
look.
Times it's
sometimes
true.
You get lazy, and you'd be like, you know, I wasn't in there that long. I'll have to check for ticks, and then all of a sudden you've got one crawling. It's almost easier to just be like, it's a bad year. Were you out in the grass?
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's take a look.
It's almost more like creepy if you don't find any because, you're like, I feel like there's got to be
one. I know you're here somewhere. Where
exactly.
are you?
Better not be one of those deer ticks. They're tiny, right?
I know. Yes, totally. Yeah. I literally take out all my aggression on them when I find one on one of my kids. Like my little teeny innocent little girl in her crib and all of a sudden there's a tick on her and take it off and I take that thing outside and I beat the living crap out of the tick and then I light it on fire, then I flush it down the toilet. I do all the things. I do. That's how mad I am at. I don't get mad at really much of anything except for wood ticks.
I taught the girls how to start the torch.
yes. Oh yeah, they burnt them. My boys are like, I want to kill that one. I want to take that one down.
But I also feel really good when I see it's just a wood tick. You can tell it's just a wood tick. You pull that one off. You're like, okay, that's not that bad. That's a wood tick.
Have you seen any North Star ticks yet?
I don't know that I would.
So it's got a white dot in the middle of it. And that one is a scary one, too. It's coming from the south. And it has a white dot in the center of it. And if you get bit by that, it changes your diet. Like, you can't eat red meat if you get bit by that. I have a friend in Tennessee that got bit.
Like, you get an allergy to it?
Well, can I get bit by it? I feel like that's a healthy move.
It's not a healthy move. You don't want this. Trust me. I do not have any ticks available. But he can't eat it. And he basically, he almost died the first time he realized it happened. He went into, I don't know if it was like a seizure or something, but he couldn't breathe. It would be like an allergic reaction. His whole body was covered in like these... I'm not describing it very well.
Like hives or something?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And his throat started to close up. He carries an EpiPen with him.
Anaphylaxis.
Yeah. And
that's very scary.
It was very scary. And that's just like one of the few different varieties of diseases that ticks carry. And that's why I hate them.
Do turkeys eat ticks?
Oh, that's a great question. Like Brandon, I feel like they...
Brandon, you got to
get on
that.
This.
Yeah. I think they might.
I could...
What? Possums do. What's your headset?
Possums do.
I'm
on it, yeah. Yeah, so my point is if you're in tick territory, there should be turkeys there. And I'm pretty amazed because, I can't go for a drive these days. And this is in the city.
I know.
Without seeing turkeys everywhere. So if you can't get one, I need to know what kind of perfume you were wearing, what kind of deterrent there was. How did you keep the turkeys away?
We looked at the trail cam and they were there like an hour before, an hour after. Honestly, it was also a little bit of girl time. So we might have been chit-chatting a little bit.
Now, it's actually a blessing that you didn't shoot a turkey because according to mosquitojoe.com online, Brandon just found it.
Sounds legitimate.
A single full-grown turkey can consume 200 or more ticks per day.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You're in the right spot, so I'm amazed that you didn't see a turkey.
We're just that bad, Ryan. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
So, we're gonna chat plenty of outdoors throughout this podcast. So buckle up, everyone. But I do want it's pretty special that we have somebody here with a background such as yourself. And I know I don't want to toot your horn too much, but really the life that you've had and the career you've had for the last several decades is kind of the dream of a lot of Minnesota people. You played in a state tournament, right? High school hockey there. You played D1 hockey in Minnesota, ended up playing in the NHL and even getting to play for your hometown team Wild eventually. Did you as yourself growing up or even when you were in high school, did you see the career that you've now had for yourself ahead of you?
No. No, I believed everybody that said, just go to school, make sure you get good grades because not many people play college hockey, professional hockey. So make sure you cover your bases. My goal always was just to play Division I hockey. It was very evident early on in my life that my parents weren't going to be paying for my college. So if I could find a way to pay for that, that was the massive win. And when it comes to hockey, I just enjoyed playing. I loved it. Again, with my parents and resource, it wasn't AAA teams, whatever you need, you're a good player, let's go. It was winter, you can play hockey, summer, you'll play baseball. I ran track. And so that's kind of what we did. And then just, I don't know. That's why sometimes now when people ask, what do you have to do for my kid to be a good player? I'm like, I don't know. Just they have to fall in love with it. And then once they love it, then maybe they'll be good. But
So we've done Wild on the Water fishing tournament for the last several years. And everybody that I jump in the boat with, I always ask the same thing with young kids growing up. I have two boys that love hockey now. But I always ask them, what did you do to get to this point? Did you play hockey all year long? Because that's what Minnesota hockey has become.
Yeah, that's what it is now.
All year. Did you?
No, gosh, no.
None of the other NHL players that I've ever asked have said that they played hockey all year long.
But what I will say are the players, the kids these days, they're better than I ever was. Mm-hmm. I watch these kids and it's oh my goodness, they are good.
That's the thing, I'm a big proponent of balanced life for people and especially kids. And so I love the idea of, take your summers off to either spend time with your family, play a different sport, become well-rounded. And that's how it has worked for all the, NHL players that we've seen before. But I do wonder now with kids playing year-round and, devoting everything, are those going to be the kids that in 10, 15 years are playing in the NHL, or is it going to be the ones that are well-rounded? And I don't know. I feel like maybe the jury's out on that.
Well, I think the answer is some of them probably are. Yeah. I mean, they're talented. They're good. The concern I have as a father now is that if they fail at certain points in life, so that's, let's say you're 18 years old, that's when you're told you're no longer able to play because you're going to be able to play in high school. You're going to find a place to play. But after that, now people are suffering these identity crises because they've been nothing but a hockey player from 10 years old to 18 years old.
Years old.
Mm-hmm. And somebody has to tell them, and that this is the truth. They're 18-year-old kids. Somebody's going to have to look them in the eye and say, you're not a player. Mm-hmm. You can't play. And then the kids are like, well, what am I going to do now? That's where I'm a proponent of the more well-rounded athlete, person, everything, where it isn't full identity set on one singular thing. I'll say that when I was done playing, it was weird because people were like, you're Ryan the hockey player. I was like, well, kind of. I'm not really a hockey player anymore. And it was my way of kind of like coping with being done. Like that wasn't my identity. It was not what I did anymore. Kids at that age that are going to have to figure that out, it's a little different. So as a parent, I try to prepare my kids in a different way where it's like, you're a hockey player, but you're also this, you're also that, you're also, you know.
Yeah, your value as a human, you know, and at home doesn't just come from
that. If you want to be a hockey player, giving, that's cool, but that's not you.
Yeah, you're giving them so many experiences to choose what they want to do outside of that.
Right.
And they can still do that, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like talking with Spurgeon about this, and he's like, oh, my kids aren't going to do it all year long like that. No way. You know, and because he didn't either, you know. So I go back to some of these things. Like right now, there's a league that my kids, both my boys, could be in, but we just decided, baseball's at the same time, we're just going to take a break, you know? Yeah. And I'm hoping that they may be a little bit behind some of the other kids, but like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things in life to enjoy.
There, I also say this, the game also always becomes hard at some point for every single player. And are the kids capable of battling through that and being good? And at times, like, so I played in the NHL. It doesn't mean I was one of the best 700, 800 players in the world. I was nowhere near it. But I was capable of battling through all the hard stuff, dealing with people telling you that they don't like you, you're not good enough, reading messages from coaches that weren't very clear. You know, you've got to do all of these different things, and you have to have the energy for it. It's not just, let's drop a puck and go play. Yeah. So you have to get them prepared for all these other things too. And being multi-sport athletes and having different coaches and different things, I think, help prepare them for that. Because ultimately, it's the kid that has to decide, I want to be good. And then they have to sacrifice all it takes to be that.
Along those lines, you know, the way that I kind of mapped out your career at the beginning, I'm sure it wasn't exactly that smooth and just one thing after the other. And like along these lines, I'm curious for you in your career, what was the biggest like leap or the hardest transition that you had either from like high school to college, you know, college to pro, or even like pro to retiring and now into what you do today?
I lived in a pretty small bubble. So I would say it was probably from high school to junior. So high school hockey, it's pretty well covered in Minnesota. You know what you're getting and you want to play in the state tournament. And then I was naive. I didn't know junior hockey, development programs, everything else out there. But you hear, like, you can fight in junior. You don't have to wear a visor. You don't even have to wear a mask if you don't want, you know. And it was weird. So when I graduated high school, and I just packed the Volkswagen Jetta and drove to Green Bay. And it was, you're playing with big boys now. Mm-hmm. They're 20 years old.
Is that a shock?
You're fighting. Oh, yeah. You're fighting for jobs. Yeah. Training camp, fighting right away. I was never fought before. So I'm punching people. I'm getting punched. It's like, this is terrible, you know. Yeah. And I remember, you know, you live with billets too. So like you went from mom's helping you, dad's helping you, you know, you've got your meals planned out, your laundry if you need it, you know, it could be done, all that stuff too. Living with a billet, not knowing where you fit in, who these people are. Not comfortable saying, hey, do you know like where my underwear are? You mind washing them for me? Yeah. What's for dinner? Right. You know, can I go to the fridge and help myself? You know, you don't know any of these things, and there's so much to learn in such a short period of time in junior hockey that I would say that was the biggest jump. That's where I remember calling my dad and saying, like, Dad, I'm done. And he's like, that's cool, bud. You can come home, but just so you know, you'll never be able to go back there. Mm-hmm. So
you said I'm done, what did you? What changed in your head to convince you to stay?
That comment that my dad was like, you can come home anytime you want. Home's always here, but you're never going to be able to go back and chase that again. So you'll be done. Just know. And it was all of it. I just had enough of all of it. The coach was hard. It's hard playing. You know, you don't want to have to fight all the time for everything, every inch. My billet family was odd. My first billet family was a little different.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They were different. You put that all together, and I mean, you can't get away from it either. It's not like you can take a weekend off, go home, see your family, and recharge. You're in it. So I would say that was my biggest jump.
When did you start to realize that professional hockey was in the cards for you? Because you were undrafted. Was there like a moment for you that you were like, I think that this might actually happen for me?
No. Yeah, there was a moment, and it was when a general manager of was the Ducks, the team that I signed for, calls and says, "Who's your agent?" And I was like, "I don't have one." And he goes, "Well, we're looking to offer you a contract. So, would you like us to give you an agent?" And I said, "That sounds like a terrible idea. I'll go find an agent." Right. So I got on the phone and got an agent. But there's a story too, where another agent I had met along the way when I was playing college hockey or junior. He's like, "Hey." You know, there were family advisors at the time before all the NIL stuff now. I apparently had told him that, why would I need an agent? I'm just trying to play college hockey. I don't need any help. I'm good to go, man. That's cool. And then it was 6 months later that I was playing professional hockey.
Wow.
He's like, dude. I was like, I don't remember. But he's like, yeah, it was, I just was focused on playing college hockey. Mm-hmm. And I was undrafted, so I didn't know the path of an undrafted free agent, if it was possible. I just had really simple and clear goals, just to be the best player that I could be on my freshman year, and then work at it and be good my sophomore year and try to climb the internal ladder. And then apparently that caught the eyes of some people. And the next thing you know, I was playing a different jersey.
Was it a real jump going from that level that you were at to the NHL? I mean, was it substantial to the amount that some kids can't do it?
Yeah, so this is also unique. It's once you get the opportunity to play at a higher level, it actually in some ways becomes easier because everybody else is that much better. So like I can count on you in gun safety, where you're mm-hmm. with young kids, you can't yeah. count on their gun safety, yeah. right? Yeah. You start going around with pros, you know, you don't even have to communicate. You know everything that's going on.
When you pass where you know it's supposed to go, the yeah. other person's
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and yeah. you can hold them yeah. accountable to it.
Sure.
Right? So it becomes a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Now there's more pressure and there's more, you know, everybody else is more talented. So offensively, you have to find a way to beat them. Defensively, you have to find a way to defend them. But I think in a lot of ways it's much easier. And then the further you get along too, the goal of a team is to limit any distractions that you might have as a person so that you can focus all your energy, because energy is finite, into the game. So they'll remove, you know, what you need off the ice, what you eat, where you rest, travel. They cover
that's Whitey's job.
Yeah, they yeah. cover all that so that you can spend 100% of your
height,
energy.
Andrew Height, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. For people that follow the Minnesota Wild, they've heard his name. He comes yeah. up throughout the year occasionally. You guys have had him on your show, mm-hmm. I think. But yeah, he's the one that keeps... I mean, I've spent a couple of days fishing with Whitey mm-hmm. up in Canada, and the stories he told. Yeah. Oh, my yeah. goodness. It's so good.
Do you know I used to work at the Wild?
Yeah,
okay, I was going to say, we could have done this offline. But yeah, it was before your time, Ryan. I was there before.
Which
you,
is hard to do. I feel like I'm getting older now. So I don't know there, how that's possible.
I think that there's one. Yeah. Spurgeon's the only player left from when I was there. Is that right? Yeah. Plenty of, like, you know, front office staff and some coaching staff and Plummer.
Oh, yeah. Fun.
And I know you've been out fishing with him too,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's fun.
How long have you been with Bally Sports now?
Boy, I don't know. I suppose I don't know. 4 years, maybe. I feel like I got done, didn't do any TV work 1 year. I went back and finished my schooling. And then that following year. So however many years I've been done playing, I think 18. So maybe 4 years.
Do you enjoy the game just as much today covering it as you did playing it? Or is it a different, complete animal for you now?
I enjoy the game. When I got done playing, I wanted to be away from it. And I enjoy being back around it again. But what I will say too with my daughters is I actually think I have more of a passion. I love the youth game more than the professional game now. And don't get me wrong, I love the job. It's just I love leaving the rink and going to the rink and watching the kids and talking to the girls and hanging out with them and seeing their excitement, trying to make their experience positive at the rink.
It's different for you now, I assume. There was a point, and maybe this happened to you and it happens to other players, but in my world, the outdoor world, I was a full-time fishing guide. I started in high school. It was my full-time job during the summer and college and then after. And I was on the water like 50 days in a row, morning and night, burnt out to the point, you know, I might get a day off every once in a while, but your season is so short that it's just compact. I came to despise fishing for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's my favorite thing to do, hunt and fish. Those are my two favorite things to do. And I hated one of them because I made it my career. I'm now in a happy place with it. But did that ever come? I mean, does that happen for you in the NHL? I mean, you've made it to the very top of your game, but it's your life for a while. And do you still enjoy it like you did when you first started?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one thing that changes that scenario in my own mind is that I always knew that my time there was limited. Mm-hmm. You know, where if you're guiding, you could do it for 30 years, right?
Yeah.
It's you're the one that has to say you're done. Nobody else is telling you that you're done. In hockey, everybody's telling you that you're almost done,
yeah.
right? And then it is somebody else's choice. It's not yours usually. Very few guys get to leave the game on their own term. Most people are told you're done.
Is it different today for players that the social media side, I mean, if they follow it and hear what fans and people are talking about them, that mental side of the game, did you have to power through that side of it, listening to the critics, the way that players do today?
Sure. It was a little easier for me because I wasn't offensively productive player. So I played forward, but I wasn't relied upon to produce. So my job was simply, if I went unnoticed, it was a pretty good game.
Yeah.
So just don't make mistakes. And that made it pretty simple. It's when the pressure mounts offensively that I think it's hard on those guys. Mm-hmm. And I never felt that pressure. Wish I would have, right? It would have been nice. I like scoring goals. But at the same time, you have a bad turnover and you open up Twitter or something and people tag in, you're like, man, what a donkey. Mm-hmm. But it happens. I do
it's
wonder.
Part of the job.
Yeah.
Having that thick skin. And
by that time, you should have been told a handful of times that you're not a good player and you should know how to handle it. Mm-hmm. Right. Or you should be aware that you're not a perfect player and that you make mistakes and how to handle it. You start taking that stuff personally, that then becomes an internal problem, less an external problem. Mm-hmm.
This concept of pressure just makes me think, like, for you, like, on one hand, being able to suit up for your hometown Minnesota Wild, like, that to me seems like it must be, like, such a dream come true. I can only imagine what it was like, you know, skating out for your first game. But, like, tell us what that was like. Do you feel, like, a big sense of, like, community and pride there? Or was it extra pressure or somewhere in between playing for the Wild?
Yeah, good. I didn't feel any pressure, I'll say that. It was probably mostly excitement. Mm-hmm. My father was a police officer in St. Paul for 30 years, and my mother grew up on Grand Avenue in St. Paul. So we were a St. Paul East Side family. I've always lived on the east side of town. We'll always live on the east side of town. So being able to play in St. Paul, make my grandparents proud, you know, father's last name, St. Paul Cobb, mm-hmm. be able to see it on the jersey and the team in town. I felt a great sense of pride. I really did. So that was exciting. And it was fun. Great, great memory for sure. First game.
That's amazing. And it is. I mean, you know, sports teams, no matter where they are, mean so much to the community. You know, of course, from like a fanfare aspect, but just from all of the businesses that are down there, you know, in St. Paul and how much that, you know, people and fans getting behind the team like impact so many people. So.
Yeah. On that end, it is cool. And it was cool. And I'm proud. But again, at the same time, that was a moment. Right. And it's weird because it takes very little time for your parents and everybody else to not really care that much. You want to come to the game? They're like, no, we're good, man.
We'll
we're good.
Like
it's like a 7-star. I think we usually hit the wrapper around 8.
Yeah.
So it's like, so you're not going to watch.
Yeah.
You know, so it happens quick. But I do feel like your career and all that stuff comes down to a couple of just, you know, tiny little moments. You put all this work into it and it's a couple of moments, but that was a big one.
Yeah.
What was a highlight for you, looking back on your journey through the NHL and hockey in general? Is there one thing that stands out to you above everything else?
Boy, I've probably been asked that. I bet you I've had a couple of different answers on it.
What stands out today?
You know, you start to think about legacy when you're towards the end and in the end. And one of the highlights of my career was there's the Stadium Series game at TCF. It was outside. I had eye black on. I had a pretty good game. And then I had two chubby little daughters with me there that day. And the photo of all of us together in that moment, you know, it means a lot to me because it's like an image, a sign that hockey brought all of us to that point. My daughters were there. I was able to share it with the people that I care about the most. And, you know, we weren't perfect by any stretch. We didn't look good in the photo, but it was pretty meaningful to me.
That's cool. That's great. It's cool that your kids are there. And maybe that's a good segue into your life today outside of hockey in the outdoor world and with your family, because that's a part of your life now that's very important. Natalie, we talked a little bit before the show, but beekeeping.
Yeah.
You're the beekeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us how you got started to that.
I have a hard time sitting still. and like, I always want to, like, if I can, try to do something to be better. And so I got the coronavirus, and it was early on. So it was like the 14 day you had to be like isolated. Mm-hmm. So I was in the basement for 14 days, and I had heard from a friend who was a beekeeper and he had seasonal allergies, and in lieu of taking a daily Zyrtec that he would eat honey from his local environment, and it carries the pollens, and through exposure therapy that it helped his symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so I have a daughter that has seasonal allergies and food allergies. So I was really intrigued. She has a nut allergy, and we've been to the allergist, and you can have exposure therapy through nut allergies to where you can eat a handful of them without an incident. Mm-hmm. And I was intrigued by that. So the one thing I could control, though, was honey. I could test that out to see if it would help my daughter in that regard. So I sat in the basement, and I read a couple beekeeping books, and I watched probably, 80 to 100 hours of beekeeping videos on YouTube. 14 days later, I walked up the stairs, and I was like, hey, hon, I'm a beekeeper. I literally jumped in the car.
Your eyes were just glazed over. Springtime then?
Yeah. This was before there was like a lot of good information on coronavirus, mm-hmm. too. So it was like, I still could be nuclear, but I wanted this.
But we got to get some bees.
I wanted these bees, and we had to get it going. Yeah. So I jump in the car. I get everything. So enough for like 2 or 3 hives and load it up. Bees show up. Boom, beekeeper. Yeah. That's how it happened.
I love hearing this because I actually have seasonal allergies too. And I feel like it's like being, okay, Brandon, you're shaking your head too. Yeah. So, and it's just
I know a lot of people, especially kids,
that love the outdoors. It's like, why have I developed? Because they just really came on probably like 6 or 7 years ago. But I mean, they get bad, especially this time of year. But I've done kind of everything that you can do to like help them. And I will say the last 2 years, they have been way better, like almost non-existent compared to what they were a few years ago. And there's a lot to it. And I actually think like stress level and like healthy eating and sleep and like all that stuff does play into it. But I started doing local honey and the bee pollen honey a few years ago. And I think that that makes a big difference. Now, what I get is like from the farmer's market, and sure, it might be like 50 miles away or something like that. So I can only imagine how, if it's like literally in your backyard, how like the pollen and the trees and everything that are right there can even be that much more effective. Have you guys like seen an improvement in your family?
Well, that's the other thing I learned. It's hard to ask like a 5 and 6 year old, how are you feeling today? Yeah. You better than yesterday?
I have no idea.
Yeah. You got no idea.
I'm hungry. I don't know.
So like over the aggregate, you have to just like really like pay attention to her symptoms and probably log it, you know, like when is it bad?
Yeah.
In counter argument to this theory, I would say that unless I'm harvesting the honey frequently, so for example, you'll have pollens that will be active now that the bees will be in, and then there will be flowers that open up in a couple weeks, and then that will continue on through the season. And it's
so
possible.
You need to harvest the honey regularly.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That makes sense.
And theoretically, honey shouldn't have pollen in it, but there are trace amounts in the honey because the bees that are out foraging for the nectar have the pollen and then they do all their things. So it could be in there. Let's say my daughter had like, what's active now, or we could do fall, goldenrod. You familiar with goldenrod? Mm-hmm. Really popular in the fall. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. Yep. So let's say I wanted to just isolate goldenrod honey. I'd have to almost take the honey resource from the bees before that, then give them the space to put it goldenrod season, then harvest the goldenrod honey. It's really kind of hard to do, but then I would be able to specifically target, this is goldenrod honey, goldenrod, whatever, give it to the daughter. Does it help your symptoms? Other hope is that you just do it all and she's getting trace amounts of all of it and you get the right blend.
Do you feel like though, just as general, like her health is, or your kid's health, or maybe your whole family, but like you've seen improvements in places that you can point to?
I wish I could. I don't know that I have noticed anything. We're happier because honey is sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sweet.
Yeah,
definitely. And then I would say it's a healthy version of sweets. Yeah. So put the donut down. Let's have a yogurt snack with honey. And we're like, it's a good idea.
So even if there's some placebo effect going on, it's like just roll with it and take it, right?
Yeah.
So walk us through like the process for people that like, I guess I've like maybe seen a couple of videos and stuff. I kind of have an idea of what it looks like, but what, like you went and you like bought bees and like how many and like what do you like, walk us through, I guess, at like a high level, like what that process is.
Yeah, anybody
like
that's considering it, you just have to do it. It all looks and sounds absolutely crazy. And it is.
You have to get the suit right away, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, you got to get the suit. And I learned the hard way because you'll watch videos and people won't have gloves on. You won't have, I don't know, I'll do it in shorts. And I've done it. Yeah. And I've done all that. And I've been stung and it's not that bad. But you get the suit, you get everything. I bought a package of bees. So I bought all the equipment. So the boxes and the frames that go inside. Mm-hmm. And
where do you buy bees? Do you go to a store? Like,
yeah,
buy them
so then you have to buy reputable bees from a beekeeper.
Yeah, we've done some stories on it. There's some in northern Minnesota that are really reputable, and they have like their day, and it's just...
Yeah, Man Lake in Hackensack.
Yeah, Hackensack Bee Day.
Yeah. Yep. There's another one that I go to over off of 694 in Oakdale, Nature's Nectar. And that's where you can get good bees. If anybody needs some bees, I have extra bees now. So just let me know.
So you've got enough that you can share bees?
Like yeah.
You've grown your own?
So I've never lost a hive over winter. And
that was one of my questions. Keep going. I want to get to that.
And when you overwinter a hive, you eventually have to split it or it will swarm. And swarm means that bees are naturally inclined to split themselves. And what happens in that sense is that the queen will be in the hive and she'll say, there's so much resource here that we can sustain another colony and I don't have to be here. So they stop feeding her so that she can fly. She lays an egg, turns into a queen cell, and then eventually a new queen will be hatched and then she'll go mate and then she'll be in that hive. And then half the working bees and the queen will just take off. They just leave. And then they find a new home.
They figure out who's leaving.
Yep, they find a new home, and then so they've just doubled their colony. So that's like their evolution, or I don't know what you'd call it, but that's, and then they continue to do that. So they'll swarm every spring if you don't split an overwintered hive. So you have to go in there after she's been laying thousands of eggs a day, take some of those bees, some of that brood, some of the eggs out, put them into a separate box, and then find another queen. And then that's like your nuke box. So those are the extra bees that you have. And then you can give like a full young colony away to somebody or sell it.
How far do they have to, like miles away?
So I've got my own swarms too. So you see them swarming. It's like chaos, but you're not going to get stung. And they'll land in a tree really close to you, most likely. And I just plucked them right out of the tree next to me, put them in a new hive box. And now I split. Now I went from one hive to two hives.
But you can do that on the same property, and they don't intermix at all?
Nope, they're looking for new spots. Now, if you were going to be mating queens all the time, you'd want to make sure that you have a variety, because then you'll have, like, I don't think it's that big of an issue, but you'll have, like, inbreeding of the queen, and then she may not be as good of a queen. Because her own drones.
Yeah.
So the mother queen lays the egg, that's the next queen, and then she splits. And then she has a drone, and that drone mates with that other baby. It's essentially a brother and a sister mating. So you'd want a variety of drones around so that they're not mating like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep the original queen in your hive, in your space, so that she's not able to leave?
Well, no, she can leave freely, but she never will leave unless she runs out of space, ironically. So the way to keep her is give her more space. So much like my wife. Much like my wife. Bigger house, nicer car. She's not going anywhere.
Bees are smart. I get it.
But legitimately, you give her more space to lay eggs. As long as she's laying eggs, she's happy. If she runs out of room to lay eggs, she's like, I'm done. That's it. I've done everything I can here. Time to move on. Mm-hmm. So you just give her more space.
But how much is your family involved in this? Your wife and your girls, like, are they out there with? I've seen pictures of you guys out there. Is it you know, one man show, or is it a team effort out there?
They're fair weather beekeepers. Uh-huh. So the suit is warm, and it's hard to tell a kid, like, power through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old are they now?
10, 8, and 6, or 10, 8, and 7 now. So they'll all come out. They're all interested in it. They want to run the smoker. They want to hold a frame with bees on it. They want to spot the queen. Harvesting the honey is work. They want to do that so they can taste it and tell their buddies, but they don't want to do the actual work. Beekeeping, it's a little bit of work too.
Yeah. What's the harvesting process like?
So in the fall, I just do it in the fall, but you set everything up to where, you know, you have your boxes. I have two deep boxes where that's where the queen gets to stay, and then she can't lay eggs above that. So that's just pure honey above that. I take everything above, and then they cap it. You have to cut the cappings off, and then it's exposed to cells. Then you put it in like a centrifuge. You spin it out. The honey all hits the end well, falls down. Then you run it through some filters, and then you've got honey.
And it lasts forever, right?
Honey is, yep. It doesn't go bad. It will crystallize based on the flowers, the nectar, and different stuff. Some will crystallize faster than others, but it never goes bad. I think that they've said that there's been Egyptians and tombs opened up where there's honey. You can eat it without getting ill.
Crazy. How much do you get like from your harvest at the end of the summer and the fall? What is it by the ounces, by the pound?
Yeah, well, I measure it by the pound. Yeah, for sure. Each hive, depending on how you set them up and how you manage the bees and your splits and all of that. But it wouldn't be outrageous to say you could get 70 to 100 pounds per hive.
That's crazy.
Yeah, wow. So that would be what? I think a 5-gallon pail is about 50 pounds, so you could get 2 5-gallon pails.
Where do they? Mm-hmm. How do they fit all that in that box? The boxes aren't that big.
No, but yeah, they do. Huh. They jam it in.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So this time of the year, what stage in the process?
So we're entering in the biggest nectar, well, the only nectar flow of the season. So spring. The flowers that open up, it's about pollen early on for the bees, and they're trying to, pollen is the protein that gets the young bees to grow into, mm-hmm. or I should say the larva into bees. And then the nectar flow hits right around June, end of May, June sometime. And then that's just, they're buzzing, just looking for honey, nectar, I should say. And then, yeah, so that's where we're at right now. I just put the supers on, which are the boxes above the queen, and they'll be, jamming those things full. They can fill a box with a nice nectar flow and a good flower. They'll fill a box in a week.
Wow. So are you familiar with No mow May, where people don't mow their lawns in May because they don't want to. Brandon, you do that? Well, yeah. So we had this conversation internally here about this, filming a story about it last mm-hmm. week, and it actually is kind of controversial now that it doesn't do what people that aren't mowing think it does, because the plants that are supposed to be doing the pollinating and all this don't actually come up until like June.
Yeah.
So May is the wrong month.
That
to
seems
be doing
about right. Like, yeah. That's how it usually goes.
I bring it up because obviously people that that don't, or maybe I should say this, Ryan, you've probably learned a lot about bees and the value mm-hmm. to this natural world because of, becoming addicted. 80 hours of watching bees, you probably learned a bit there, and then watching them in real life. What's been your biggest takeaway from the bees and what they do in the world here?
Well, I tell you what, I appreciate them too. I like the way that a colony is set up, that there's a queen, that they all work, that they all sacrifice for the betterment of the colony. Mm-hmm. I love all those messages that I can tell my girls about. I also love that it's all females. And I've got only daughters, so mm-hmm. you can talk about how this whole colony survives solely based on the work of females. The males, the drones, they're simply there to mate and reproduce.
Mm-hmm. world.
Some parallels.
I'll refrain from commentary.
So that's cool. But I do appreciate, one bee, there's some stats out there, and they may be slightly off, but for the most part, they're accurate. 3 out of every 4 bites on your plate will be pollinated or will be there because of a pollinator and a honeybee. So whether that be the vegetables, the fruits, the breads, the everything that you kind of have, make, bake, whatever, will be from that. Your beef, if they're eating different grasses, alfalfas, right. and all that stuff. So 3 out of every 4 bites come from a pollinator. So they are important.
That's what I think a lot of people don't grasp.
Yeah.
You know, just how valuable it is. So when you see a bee, I do this too, where I'm like, I need to protect my little 1-year-old.
Yeah.
I need to protect my kids, but I also don't want to kill you because I know how important
Move away.
You are.
Yeah.
We're just going to back up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Let that bee have its space there.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I think, something that stands out about you, obviously, you've had your hockey career, you're working a lot, you've got 3 girls, they're in sports, I'm sure just like so many people today, life's busy, but it seems, from talking to you a little bit before and just, what you share online and stuff, that you do prioritize trying to, have a balanced life with your family and having 3 girls, it seems like you're able to get in some like outdoor time with them and to kind of share your love of the outdoors, of course, through beekeeping and a little bit through fishing with them too. Have you guys been out fishing much recently? I know I saw some like bass pictures last year.
Yeah, we were out this weekend up for Memorial Day to open up the cabin and get mm-hmm. everything going. And 2 of the 3 were able to catch some perch off the dock, and they were pretty stoked awesome. About that. But yeah, we get out and we fish. The girls enjoy it. I like to just be outside. Mm-hmm. So I'm always out there, and it's actually cool. My kids are still at an age where they kind of just want to be around mom or dad. Mm-hmm. So whatever they're doing, the kids will do. So if I'm out putzing around or if I'm out fishing, it's always like, hey, you want to go? They're like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
You know, they're not quite screenagers yet. Yeah. Where they want to be on the screen.
Keep them that way so, as long
yeah,
as
possible. I'm trying.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
The goal is to be as fun and as cool as possible so mm-hmm. that they want to hang out with you as much as possible.
Yeah. And that's like, we've talked about that a little bit, but it's like, I think I hear this so much. It's like, if you want, you know, your kids to be into something, if you tell them that they have to do it, you're probably going to get the pushback. And that if you make it fun, lead by example, just get them out there and help them, you know, succeed, catch some fish, that they can, you know, they can be drawn to it on their own. Mm-hmm. And maybe stick with it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Have you guys targeted, because I know you went muskie fishing yep. a couple years ago. Do you still do that very much?
I'm almost exclusively a fall muskie guy. Okay. I'll turn it on September, and if I get a chance between September and October to fish, it's going to almost exclusively be muskie. Mm-hmm. But this time of year, no. And the girls can't handle that heavy equipment yet. I would hook them up if you could troll for them. Sometimes I feel like that's not like the purest way to musky fish. Like, you have to grind and you have to cast, and you know, you got
10,000 casts before.
Yeah, you got to do it. You can't just go troll out there and hope you catch one.
You said you have 10, 8, and 6?
7. She's turned 7.
Okay.
Now,
gotcha. So I'm 9, mine are 9, 7, 5. And then I have a 1-year-old too. But the last 2 years, I've had the boys out casting, and it's amazing. I've learned that kids learn, you know, I told you before that I've been fishing guide for a long time. Kids learn the quickest of any. Kids, then women, then men. Mm-hmm. Men are the most stubborn. They're hardest to teach anything. But it's amazing how quickly kids will learn. And so I always
they don't bring
people,
the ego to it, and the you know yeah, they, ready to learn.
Yeah, they just kids have this amazing ability to just absorb information, and mm-hmm. you just have to give them a little bit of space. But I switched from the Snoopy poles real early in life and got them some better equipment because they then catch these huge fish and they're like, let's go fishing again. I want more of that. Mm-hmm. Don't know that they would have been able to land it on such a little tiny rod. So I always tell parents, I'm like, hey, if you have the equipment to try earlier, it seems like it really jumpstarts their joy for fishing when mm-hmm. they have the right stuff to catch it.
So what'd you go with then after the Snoopy rod? Because Snoopy's like the old Zabco closed
face,
you know, upright. Do you go open face?
Opposite? The spinning reel. I was spinning amazed reel? At how, I'm like, okay, you see this? You just get your finger and you grab the line right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, they did it half a dozen times. And in my front line, I just tied on those little
rubber,
the bobbers that mm-hmm. are used for like your keychain.
Yeah.
So they're soft. Yeah. And they're heavy enough that they can cast.
The floaters.
It's just attached to your keychain.
Yeah, you got
to
do something
so you don't
heavy.
Lose your keys.
Like your boat keys.
Your boat keys. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I had them casting that in the yard, and they're stuck up in the trees and everything. But they really learned quickly how to cast a spinning reel.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're good with that. With muskies, you know, you get a big topwater lure. It's pretty heavy. So mm-hmm. you can teach them how to use a bait caster really fast. It's hard to use a bass, you know, a low profile bait caster with a light lure because you get the backlashes. But when you're with musky fishing, it's all about letting the rod do the work. So mm-hmm. you just tighten down the tension a little bit and they can zing it. In the first few casts, it went like 10 feet, mm-hmm. but they didn't backlash. I was like, okay, a little further, a little bit more. And pretty soon they're zinging it out there half as far as, you know, as a Ryan Carter would launch it, but they're in the game.
Yeah.
And then they got to follow right away too. So
that's
like,
great.
Every day, let's go musky fishing, Dad.
Yeah, I'm gonna need a new pair of polarized glasses too. Exactly. I think I only saw the tail.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, I've had success teaching kids on spinning reels too, and it's just like being, you know, again, heavy lure, and then going in like as the adult in the situation with like the fun and the positive attitude, and also a lot of patience because like there's gonna be all sorts of messes and lines. You're gonna like. My experience end up taking the reel off at some point to fix a mess, but it's just like getting them the practice.
Yeah.
You know, they can do it.
I'll give you an example of so fishing opener the last 2 years, it's been me and the kids, and we've tried to make a new tradition out of fishing opener. We have this huge giant Rapala lure. You've seen those ones in the mm-hmm. stores. And that's like the trophy from the end of the day. Whoever catches the biggest walleye gets the trophy. Well, I've got my nephew, my two boys, and my 5-year-old daughter. And the two older boys are like super competitive, you know, they're like, this is our year, we're going to get it. And they've got they know how to pitch a jig and they bait their own hook. They do everything. I don't have to do anything. Lydia, we have donuts because we got to have a lot of snacks for the kids. Lydia is a 5-year-old and Cash is my 7. They love being out there because they still enjoy doing things with me. And they also, they love fishing, but not like the older two boys. Anyway, she makes a couple of casts and then we have donuts. So she's like, I'm going to eat a donut. I pick up the rod and I launch it out there and I jig it twice and I feel the thud. And I go, Lydia, come here. And I hand her the rod and the fish is already on it. And she reels in a 26-inch walleye.
Really?
Wow. Yes.
Boys are, everyone's pumped and instantly it clicks for the two oldest boys. They're pissed because they're not going to beat this 26-inch
walleye. The competition comes out.
And then they're like, yeah, well, you know, she didn't really catch it.
Yeah.
You know, that's not really hers. I mean, that was yours. And I'm like, buddy, you know. And this lasted a couple of days. We had to have this conversation. Like, buddy, when you were 5, I was helping you too. But like,
speaking
she gets
of good
lessons
for kids to learn is you don't win all the time.
Yeah, but and so then also the 7-year-old who was kind of like, he tied every lure on in the tackle box until he was bored of it. Then he's ready to go. So now, okay, he's ready to go. We're leaving on a high. The older boys are like, we don't want to go. We didn't catch a big one yet. But like everybody had their moment there and we left wanting more. And I always tell parents too, I'm like, you have these great experiences. Everyone's happy. Some are mad. They still want more, but like they'll get those chances later. But I didn't want to burn my 7-year-old out and make him stay out there too long and then come to despise fishing. So we always end when the first person is ready to go.
Yeah.
And that's a day in our family fishing opener now. Yeah.
But that's a fundamental truth. Once you have more than 2 children, you know, like the third one, if you're all together, somebody's always going to be mad.
Yeah.
You know, somebody's always going to be disappointed. You can count on it. Yeah. And if you're going to eventually have 4, it sounds like, in the boat at one time, there's going to be a couple mad no matter what. So it's always going to be the case. And that's, you know, I feel like that's dad's job, put out the fire. But 3 kids, someone's always going to be mad. 2 can be happy. That's like the max. It's never all 3. Somebody's always mad. Yeah. But
that's the journey. That's the fun. Keep them out there.
Right.
Yeah. We're avoiding the screens as much as possible, like you mentioned. And so far they're, you know, like we got a minnow trap now. And my son, I'm like, here's some things we can put in it. First day we put the trap out in this little ravine. It's only like maybe 1.5 feet deep. It runs through behind our property and it connects to random ponds throughout the city. Well, we had crayfish, bullheads, sticklebacks, fatheads, and I don't know if there was a sunny in that one, but like every 20 minutes, my son's like, let's go check the trap.
Yeah.
Let's go check.
And it's he's so got to
put, you put bread in it. That's what brings the fish in. So he's big into trapping minnows now.
Yeah.
So you're just like letting him have these different experiences and I don't know, making fun.
Yeah. Stoking that curiosity. It's going to carry through.
Totally.
So have you always, Ryan, have you always liked the outdoors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just like being outside.
Yeah.
I hate being inside.
Is it something you did as a kid, too?
Yeah, I mean, literally, I would just try to find things to do to fill my time outside. Yeah. I think that's how I probably got started in a lot of it. My father doesn't hunt. He doesn't fish. He doesn't golf. He doesn't do a lot of that stuff. So a lot of it was just hanging out with buddies, being a yes guy, and getting a chance to do it and learning to like it. But if you can't tell by my color, I'm just out. Like, even at home, I'll just be putzing.
Can't
outside.
Be inside.
Yeah, I'll just be putzing outside.
What's your favorite outdoor, non-sports related activity that you like to do?
I like fishing. So, like, my zen moment is probably smallmouth fishing on the lake, early morning, sun's coming up, the lake is calm, it's quiet, no boats. Like slight breeze, but still kind of calm water where I can spot fish them. Mm-hmm. That would be like my moment.
This is just pure magic this time of the year then when they're up in the shallows.
Yeah. You can see them on a rock pile and you sneak up there. It's quiet. You throw it past them. You bring it there. You see them move. You wait and you rip it. And you're like, yes, got it.
Natalie's getting all
I know. I'm getting all I think I just zoned out. I forgot I needed to participate in this conversation. I'm just off of my old world daydreaming. But
You mentioned sunrise. So I always ask people, sunrise or sunset? If you can only watch one, which one?
Sunrise.
I'm rise all day, every day because I find the bugs aren't. And sunset, I want to go fish walleye at sunset and go into, so we're on a super clear lake and the walleye rarely bite during the daylight. You have to get them at night. Mm-hmm. And I can't do it because it's like, I don't want to fight through the bugs or be glowing with DEET just to catch a couple of fish. So I prefer going to bed and waking up early in the morning to do it.
I feel like practically speaking too, sunrise for sure. And I think like I've always just been a sunrise person, and it feels like a little bit more special. And I think, like,
it's
practically,
it is. Not yeah, many people that are up,
and that's like
lazy.
Depending on where you are, what lake you're at, or, you know, the Twin Cities, or even, you know, up north. Like sometimes this, you know, sunset, you're, you know, you can barely keep standing on a boat with, you know, wakeboarders going yeah. by and stuff and all the waves. So it depends, but I think either way, boat traffic or not, sunrise is my favorite. It's just special.
There's something to it too that's a little more rewarding because it's a grind. Yeah. There's like a sacrifice to a sunrise.
You did it.
Like I feel like I've made my near 40 years of life the sunset almost every day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I've never gone to bed before the sun has set.
Not a big deal.
Right? So I've experienced every single sunset. I've not experienced every single sunrise. So
that's
I think I appreciate
point,
it a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask, I feel like there's a lot of NHL players or hockey players that are outdoorsmen as well. I think that there's probably some that you've fished with. We've done the Wild on the Water many mm-hmm. times. If you were to have to enter a fishing tournament, any species, with one member of, with one former teammate, who would it be?
I think it would have to be Alex Stalock. I fished with him before too. So there'd be plenty of beer, plenty of stories.
I think this is more of plenty of stops.
You know? He became very unhelpful to our fishing team by halfway through the contest.
Yeah.
We'll just say that.
Yeah.
He's
plenty of stops. Like, I think there's a bar right over there. Yeah.
So you're not going to win. You're going to have a good time.
Oh yeah. But he fishes too. So that would be a fun one on the water. We've gone out a few times, but yeah.
Sure.
When we fished, we're on Mille Lacs, and there's this massive storm coming across the lake. Like, you can just see it. Mm-hmm. And
that was Wild on the Water.
Yeah, Wild on the Water. And so he and I are captains of the players' team that year. And so we go in, and back in was Izades, and mm-hmm. he's like, oh, we're going back out? Like, he thought this is it for the day. He's done. he was not ready to go back out.
Yeah.
Sorry, Daisy.
Yeah.
Daisy's in the room.
He did like a video bit that day and the wind was like howling. You couldn't hear anything. Oh man, that's what I mean. You go, that's part of it too. It's just fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good spot.
Yeah. So we're off season for you right now. What, any big plans you have or things that you're excited about, this summer?
Well, we like to log as many hours at the lake as we can. It's getting harder because the girls' activities are getting a little bit more intense. Got some golf outings, a fishing trip planned. We'll be trying to chase muskie. Actually, I got to go back. We're taking a trip to Canada in late August to, I think, maybe Lac Seul or Menaki.
Yeah.
One of those.
You're going to Lac Seul. That is just like, that's the top. That's huge fish up there.
Yeah. And that's where I'm at right now. It's like, I don't have enough time to go throw 10,000 casts. Mm-hmm. So if I have to spend a few more hours to limit that to like maybe a couple hundred casts, that's what I got to do. So that's the plan.
Have you ever musky fished up there before?
No. I've walleye fished. Like, my favorite walleye spot was Eagle Lake.
In Ontario?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was Ontario. So straight north.
Yep.
Yeah, right above International Falls, you go through, I don't remember the other places, but Dryden, Ontario, Kenora. Yeah.
Yep. That's Ontario.
Yeah. So it was great. We stayed at a resort, and the resort had a boat. So we went through like a couple lakes, some crazy little shallow river that was like a logging river, go through Clear Lake, which is off of the big Eagle Lake, then off to another one. And then there's just this little boat flipped upside down, and you got to bring your own motor. We brought a 3-horse motor and a little gas can. And then you go out onto McGregor Lake, and there's not a cabin. There's nothing around. And you drop in, and you're just walleye after walleye after walleye.
Those are the best.
Nobody else around. A little 3-horse. I never thought I'd be so stoked to be in a little dinghy with a 3-horse motor, but it was awesome. So
that's awesome.
Cook them up on shore then?
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't have a lot of the resource because we were carrying motors and everything else.
Well, we asked you earlier your favorite hockey memory. Do you have a favorite fish or fishing memory?
Let's see. I've got a 51 inch muskie, which was fun.
Nice.
And I
casting
think
it, or trolling?
Casting. It well was done.
Top water or bucktail?
Top water.
Yeah.
Oh.
So the made fishing right. gods paid it forward. I was supposed to go up to Vermilion. This is September 29th. I was supposed to go up to Vermilion. This was the lockout of 2013, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to get away in September. And I've got a boat. And my buddy was going to haul the boat up because my pickup was already shipped, or for some reason I didn't have a way to pull the boat, but I had my boat. Mm-hmm. And he came over and the lights weren't working. So we were supposed to leave about 7 at night and I couldn't get the lights hooked up. And I was like, dude, I'm just not comfortable pulling the boat at night without lights. So he's like, all right, I'm out. And he went north and they fished and I stayed back. But I ended up fishing the following night with another buddy on White Bear Lake right out the back door. And sun was setting, top water, and then just
did it wake or did it explode?
Just splashed. It was just dark enough to where I couldn't see, heard, and bring it in. And it's a 51 inch muskie, great fish, blind in one eye. Mm. So she's probably been caught before, I thought. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for all those scenarios, I'm not on the water at that spot, that point. They pay it forward. A fish that's blind in one eye, sunset. Yeah. She needs the audible whop, 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 probably to locate where the everything is. So that was kind of like my, oh, man, that's a good decision, not traveling without the boat lights.
Good for you.
Make it work.
Responsibility.
Well, it's just like the... It was like the fishing gods paying it forward, and I appreciate that. Yeah.
Nice. That's a cool thing about muskies, too. And even people that don't fish for muskies or don't really understand the fish, like, if you ask them about a fishing story, usually it's an encounter with a muskie for some reason or another. Maybe they've been reeling in a bass, you know, and then here it comes following behind it, you know, because they're opportunistic feeders. They feed up. They see something struggling. They come up and take a look. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's a story that revolves around a muskie usually, and you don't need to catch very many to have them quickly become this, you know, amazing fish that you always remember.
Right. And that's always like you can catch a big bass or a big walleye, but the photo that you have is your muskie photo.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
At least in Minnesota.
And people who don't fit, I mean, they're like, A, what is that? B, that's in the lakes that I'm swimming in. Yeah. Like, that's crazy.
The irony is too, like, you go to Florida or somewhere else, like a muskie's not even a big fish.
Yeah.
You know?
But so, here it but scares still. People. Yeah. They don't want to swim. That's in our lake.
Yeah.
No way. We're never swimming there again.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still you'll catch like a medium tarpon, but you're not as stoked about that as you are like a 50-inch muskie. No, but that's next on the list.
Yeah. That's my on my list, the number one fish that I haven't caught.
On a fly rod?
Well, it's either a fly or
muskie setup.
Yeah, I want to catch it on a topwater bait.
Yeah,
that's to me the excitement. Like that's the rush. I don't want to have it. You know, a little crayfish,
crab, whatever. Crab. Honestly, it is. I mean, they're such powerful fish, and when you get the jumps, I've done them both with live bait, and it's the easiest way. You know everything, but like you can still sight cast for them. And honestly, I mean, the purists are gonna say like, yeah, no, you got to do it the right way. But like when you get them to jump, like the aerials are unbelievable, but you can fish for them on essentially musky setups. And I haven't done top water, but I've done swim baits for them, and getting to actually just like cast for them, I mean, they're awesome. You're gonna love it.
And I want to do it where again, where you're casting or it's you. Like I've gone salmon fishing and caught big salmon in the Great Lakes, and that's kind of fun. But
they're trolling out the back.
Yeah, less like the charter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So even like a marlin or something, I think it'd be really cool, but where you just hook a lure up and then you travel with your, you know, and you throw your feet up and you wait for it. Mm-hmm. And then that's whose turn is it to reel in? That's a little different. I like actively
you're
fishing.
The one that made it happen.
I like
you're
actively
the
one that fishing.
Like the
that's why
work.
I like bird hunting.
Yeah.
Because it's like I need the activity.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't like
world with me bird hunting. What kind of hunting?
I wouldn't like deer. And I have done it. I don't like deer hunting as much because it's inactivity. I have to sit there.
Yeah.
That's really hard for me to do.
I feel like this parallels your hockey career.
Yeah.
You want to go grind in the corner and you want to do the dirty work.
Let's go do it.
So do you like to bird hunt then too?
Yeah. So
we just become best friends.
And I'm an upland guy more than duck hunting. I like duck hunting. But pheasants are probably what I like the best. You chase them, you look, you see, you know, you're walking. I've come to appreciate the dogs and, you know, my stepfather has the dog that we hunt with and he could just leave the gun in the car because he just enjoys the tail wag and the excitement from the dog. And I've learned to really love that too. But, the activity of upland hunting is, or upland hunting is what I like.
Yeah. So we do North Outdoors, obviously, but I host two other bird hunting shows, The Flush and Rooster Tails, and that takes us all over North America. And this dog here that I just rolled my chair over the top of that yelp a minute ago, she is just like this bird finding, heat seeking missile out there. Mm-hmm. And the places that upland bird hunting has taken us, like you climb over the mountain, you know, out west or different, you know, up in Alaska and things like that, and just you can just appreciate this world. And the bird brought you there, but you got to experience so much more because of it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, how about grouse hunting? I've never done it. I think I would like it.
You would.
But
I've never taken anybody out that hasn't just instantly been like, that's awesome.
Because, really?
Yeah, there's something about the forest in the fall, that the changing season. You know, like there's a smell out there that, you know, the colors, the leaves are dropping. Mm-hmm.
So you like fall?
I love it. It is if you took October 15th through November 15th, it's the best 30 days of the year for fishing and hunting because everything is happening.
That's the hard part about it.
Everything is happening. The best fishing of the year, the best hunting of the year, the migration, everything is happening. The rut for big game animals, the mating season for them, the migration for waterfowl, ducks and geese. And then the upland hunting as well. Plus the fish are getting ready for winter. It's just like there's change happening. There's so much in the wild world that's happening in the fall. And if I miss one day between in that window, I'm like so mad because it's you got to wait 320 more days for it to come back. It is magical. Yeah. If you ever want to experience a grouse hunt, we don't have to go far from here. And that girl right there curled up is just, oh.
I think for sure I'd like grouse hunting, but I have to confess, I hate fall.
Why?
Well, are you busy that time?
That's part of it. My whole life, it's back to school. It's back to work. And then it's just it's like death. Like, there go the leaves.
Yeah, but you've got this whole new...
Everything's like dying. It just feels like we're preparing for death. Like, here comes
renewal. Renewal. But
So, mating fall season. Gets me.
You're not preparing for death. You're preparing for life.
Yeah, yeah. If fall gets me. I'd rather just go
straight. The days are getting shorter.
Summer. Yeah. Yeah, days are getting shorter.
You can put a fleece on and you're comfortable. Yeah. It's the best.
Well, so this fall, you can just request a change to the hockey schedule. Make sure that they have a couple weeks off for you, and then the two of you can go grouse hunting. And I think you're going to change your mind on fall.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
That's maybe I just need
you're
to enjoy it. To it.
You're gonna have
once I enjoy it to its fullest. Once I enjoy it to its fullest.
Yeah,
for sure. The friends that I took into the field last year all have puppies right now that they're training to hunt because of the grouse hunting we did last fall with her, and just seeing what it's like to have a dog that like is trained for that is so cool to be in the woods. And you know, like we saw a bear, we saw deer, everything else, but the birds and being in there and then the meal afterwards. I mean, I've got some recipes that are simple, but yet at the end of a good day in the woods, you're tired, you eat that, have a cold one, whatever you like to drink. And it's just like, oh, can we do this every day?
Right.
You just love it. Yeah. All right. Well, Natalie,
probably about out of time today. I feel like we could just keep picking your brain on everything, but we'll let you go. But this was great getting to chat with you. And I think, it's good change of pace. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is fun.
Right. Yo, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate
all you do. We enjoy watching you on TV. Yep. And it's cool to see that you're raising up your family in the outdoor world too.
Yeah. And the bees, keeping the bees. Yeah.
Keep it with the bees.
Save the bees.
Yeah. So. There you go.
I've got no plugs. I do have a surplus of honey. So if you're ever on the east side of town, I found a place that will put it on their shelf and they'll...
Do you sell it?
I don't want to have like a marketplace, you know, or have to like fill orders or do the work for that. Uh-huh. But like I said, if I have three hives and I'm getting, you know, 150, 200 pounds of honey, we can't eat that. Yeah. You know, what are we going to do with it? And back to one of the stats real quick. I know we want to go, but... I think one bee will visit a million flowers to make one little tiny or third, less than a teaspoon of honey in its life. So like when I've got gallons, I just picture like the lives of all these bees, and I'm like, I can't waste that. Yeah. I want somebody to enjoy it.
Yeah.
So that's right.
You've done all that work.
Yeah. So I'm saying like even like to bear hunters, like if you guys want, I'll hit me up, man. I'll give you honey so that you can feed the bears.
Careful what you ask for here.
Yeah. That's still a little different. Yeah. That's just luring the bears in.
See, I can't speak to the honey thing, but like if I grow a carrot. You know, like you could buy a bag of carrots and it's no big deal to take a bite and then my kids don't finish it. But if they don't finish one that we grew, eat that carrot or I'm going to eat it. I can't throw that away. It's different when you've grown it yourself.
Right. Yeah. So I've got all this honey and I'd prefer it to be consumed, used, and the energy of that one bee and that teaspoon of honey goes to good use.
Sweet.
Well, we'll be dropping links to your social media and your podcast in the description. So be ready for an influx of messages.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks.
All right.
It was fun. Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on. It was great.